highs in the mid to upper 70s. Our lows tomorrow night in the upper 40s, and for Friday, sunny, highs in the low to mid 70s. Thank you for tuning in to KAXE this evening.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens...
It took a lot of patience. A medical researcher who's devoted his career to Huntington's disease tells us the results of a new trial constitute what he calls the best news we've ever had in the Huntington's disease community. Because a disease that has always been untreatable may now be treatable.
And duck and cover. There's growing unrest in the world of competitive duck stamp painting due to the dominance of three Minnesota brothers in the annual U.S. Federal Duck Stamp Art Contest. And this year's win has ruffled feathers even further.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens in a few minutes here on KAXE. Also, we'll hear The Set List, some live music you can check out this weekend. Right now, let's listen to our album of the week, Ain't Done With the Blues by Buddy Guy. This is his 34th album, released on his 89th birthday. It showcases his dedication to the genre by tying in the history and impact of the blues while weaving in his personal stories. Buddy Guy covers a lot of territory in these 18 tracks with doo-wop, R&B, Delta blues, and gospel. The song we're going to hear this evening is called Upside Down.
This is The Set List on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at four shows this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, September 26th through the 28th in Bemidji and Grand Rapids. Starting things off with Brock Bolio at Bridget's Pub in Bemidji, Friday at 7 p.m. Bolio is a soulful singer and bluesy guitarist who mixes originals and covers, and he also plays guitar and bass with Corey Medina and Brothers. It's Brock Bolio this Friday at Bridget's in Bemidji. On to Saturday, it's Clocktoberfest all day at Clocko Brewing with three acts on the lineup. kicking off the day will be Nathan Newman, a polka musician and accordion player from St. Cloud with a wide repertoire of German traditional music. After Newman, Lone Rock Bridge are playing, a six-piece alt-country band from the Twin Cities who released their debut album, Rosette, earlier this year. Wrapping up the evening will be Barn Dancing with Terrence Smith and the Old Time String Band. It's Clocktoberfest all day this Saturday at Clocko Brewing. Over at Rapids Brewing, rock and roll group Rich Matson and the North Stars are playing Saturday at 7. Tim Saxhog of Trampled by Turtles will be joining the long-running Iron Range band on bass. Their latest release was the single Not the Answer from earlier this year. Rich Matson and the North Stars at Rapids Brewing this Saturday. And on Sunday, acclaimed folk singer and one-man band Martin Sexton is also at Rapids Brewing. Sexton is on tour playing the music of Abbey Road and will be covering the final Beatles album in its entirety alongside his own original music. Martin Sexton this Sunday at Rapids Brewing. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we'll post the latest edition every Wednesday at kaxc.org.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
a pinch-me moment. Huntington's disease was untreatable, but the results of a new gene therapy are so promising that when he saw them, one researcher tells us he thought he was dreaming.
A second opinion. The U.S. government is spreading extremely dubious information about the causes of autism when a mother of two children with autism tells us what they need most is acceptance.
Crossing a line, a human rights advocate tells us Israel's closure of the only gateway from the occupied West Bank to the outside world risks penning Palestinians in and is deepening fears about what might be next.
Voice of Experience. The late Louise Vincent used lessons from her own life in her work as a harm reduction advocate and researcher. A friend tells us she never claimed to be in recovery and never apologized for using.
Duck Dynasty. A young artist defends the dominance of a trio of brothers who are so good at painting ducks they just can't stop winning the annual U.S. Federal Duck Stamp Art Contest, despite a push to clip their wings.
And scale models. Music teachers in movies strike a chord for all of us. But according to a new study, their miraculous methods make it harder for their real-life counterparts. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that knows how to find out how good a music teacher is. Just inquire in choir. For the first time, researchers say they have treated Huntington's, a debilitating, deadly genetic disease that's long been believed to be incurable. New results from a trial of 29 patients show that 3 years after gene therapy, the disease had slowed by an average of 75%. The results were released by the gene therapy company uniQure, which developed the treatment, but the research has not yet been published for review by other specialists. The trial was run by a team at University College London. Ed Wild is the principal investigator at the school's Huntington's Disease Center trial site. We reached him in London.
Professor Wild, I know researchers and scientists are usually stoic and controlled and sober about what they're looking at when they look at results, but when you saw these results from this work, how did you react?
Well, I'm sober, but I don't think people would describe me as a stoic. I'm still in Huntington's disease after 20 years because I have, I guess, what could be described as unbridled optimism. So you have to adjust for that. But I don't think it's at all a stretch to say that this is the best news we've ever had in the Huntington's disease community. And I include in that the discovery of the gene 30 plus years ago. Today is the day that we get to move Huntington's disease into the column labeled treatable from the one labeled untreatable. And that's truly a momentous occasion for everyone.
This will no doubt be a day you won't forget, though I suspect it'll be a blur of interviews and conversations. But that day where you saw the results with the team,
yeah.
Do you remember those moments? Are they forever burned in your mind?
I remember as if it were a dream. I remember just before we had the call where we learned what the top line results were, I was saying to my friend and colleague, Sarah Tabrizi, who I work with on this program, that we needed to really manage our expectations downwards because nothing amazing ever happens in incurable brain diseases. And then when we saw the results and we saw that the gene therapy had slowed the progression of Huntington's disease by 75%, we were truly blown away. It's not an exaggeration to say that it dramatically exceeds our wildest expectations.
Yeah, Professor Tabrizi was saying in another interview that she was moved to tears. She was crying because she's worked in this space, like you, for decades now. To tell our listeners who may not be familiar with what Huntington's disease can do to a person, just take them through a little bit about what patients are dealing with.
Yeah, Huntington's disease, I mean, so the scientific basics are that it's a genetic condition. It's caused by a single mutation in a gene that tells the brain how to make a particular protein called Huntington. And when there's an error in the gene, the form of the protein that's made is harmful, it's toxic, and we call it mutant Huntington. The genetic inheritance is such that everyone who has Huntington's disease, each of their children has a 50% risk that they inherit the mutation. And if they inherit it, it's 100% certain that they'll develop Huntington's disease at some point. Typically, it comes on in a person's 30s or 40s. And from that time onwards, they experience a fairly rapidly accelerating loss of function, which tends to start with subtle things like multitasking ability or the ability to function at work. But within a year or two, most people, after symptom onset, are no longer able to work in the usual role or at all. They have to take medical retirement. They develop involuntary movements. They lose the ability to walk. They need to use a wheelchair. Eventually, everyone with Huntington's disease becomes bedbound. On top of that, it's a form of dementia. So it's a real stripping away of what it is that makes us ourselves.
So in terms of how this treatment works, we're talking about this drug that you tested. It's a long surgical procedure in addition to that 3 years that you were tracking folks. What happens in that procedure?
Yeah, so it's a gene therapy. And the upside of that is that a single treatment should last a whole lifetime. The surgery is it's roughly 12 hours, sometimes longer, up to 18 hours. And it's done under MRI scan guidance. So the trajectory of the little tubes called catheters is very, very carefully planned. But from then on, that person is essentially treating themselves for the rest of their life. The neurons that are most vulnerable have been reprogrammed. So it's a complicated procedure. And the science, of course, is pretty intense. But at the fundamental level, we're basically turning down the volume knob on the thing that causes harm.
You've made it very clear there, just in that answer. And as you made clear earlier in our conversation, we're talking about a slowing, not an eradication of what is happening to these patients who have Huntington's. So, is the early access to something like this critical for these patients if they're later along? In experiencing Huntington's, is it less effective?
That we don't know yet, because all of the patients in the current trial were very similar in that they all had very early symptomatic Huntington's disease. So they were all probably within a year or two of symptom onset, which is the sweet spot for testing a new therapy, because you can tell if it's working, and you can also tell if it's causing problems. But the positive result from this trial in early symptomatic HD now needs to be tested in the real world. And what we're hoping is that the gene therapy will end up being licensed for the treatment of everyone with Huntington's disease. Mm-hmm. Prioritize people according to who's likely to get the most benefit, but we can explore the option of treating people before symptoms to prevent or delay onset, and also see how late in the disease we can still produce benefits. Mm-hmm. So nothing's off the table at this point, because it's the same gene and the same protein that's problematic throughout the life of someone who's inherited that gene.
I can hear the excitement in your voice, the possibilities, the open road ahead of...
I can't wait to get cracking.
That's lovely to hear. I wonder what you think your research might mean for whether or not people, young people in particular, decide to test if they have the gene.
It's a strange phenomenon. The gene was discovered in 1993, and lots of people at the time thought that everyone would want to go and get tested. But history has taught us that it's actually only probably one person in five, and the absence of an effective treatment has been one of the major reasons why people choose not to get tested. So one of the challenges ahead is that we probably now will have to ramp up by a factor of four or five the rate at which we're able to take people through genetic counselling and get those tests done. So there's a lot of work ahead, but that's a problem that I'm happy to be facing right now in 2025.
Professor, I'm very glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Ed Wild is the principal investigator at University College London's Huntington's Disease Centre trial site. We reached him in London. For Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank, freedom of movement has always been curtailed. But as of today, a key border crossing between the West Bank and Jordan is closed, and with it, residents' only way of getting in and out of the region without going through Israel. Israeli authorities first shut the Allenby Bridge, also known as the King Hussein Bridge, last week after a Jordanian truck driver entering the occupied territories killed two Israeli soldiers there. Now it's been closed again, and a government statement today describes that closure as indefinite. Omar Shaker is the Israel and Palestine Director for Human Rights Watch. He was based in Jerusalem until Israel expelled him in 2019. We reached him today in Palo Alto, California.
Omar, I know you've been to this crossing yourself many times. So what is it like there, usually, on any given day?
The crossing is often very, very crowded. This is the main point of entry and exit to the West Bank. So for Palestinian ID holders, it is their outlet to the outside world. It is also a common entry and exit point for Palestinians from occupied East Jerusalem, as well as for foreigners that are hoping to spend time visiting either Israel and or the occupied Palestinian territory. So, whether you're showing up from Israel or Palestine or from Jordan, it involves many people, many rounds of questioning by Jordanian, by eventually Israeli, for Palestinians also Palestinian Authority security forces, a lot of time waiting, and at times, especially during the summertime, it can be very, very crowded, and the experience can be quite humiliating, particularly when you're entering and being questioned by Israeli authorities.
Even with all of those realities, it is an easier option in many ways for people to enter and exit if you compare it to a border crossing in Israel or to travel through Ben Gurion International Airport. Isn't that right?
I think we have to distinguish here between foreigners and for Palestinians. Mm-hmm. When you're a Palestinian ID holder, you don't have any other option because to use Ben Gurion Airport, you need a rarely issued permit by the Israeli army, which is near impossible for Palestinians to obtain. So their only way to travel outside of the occupied Palestinian territory, outside of the occupied West Bank, is via the Amman airport. So that is their only outlet. For foreigners, they obviously have other options, but for Palestinians, it's really their only option.
So the implications then for Palestinians, if this crossing was closed permanently?
Enormous. I mean, it would shut down their access to the outside world. Unless there is a corresponding action taken, it would mean that Palestinian ID holders, we're talking in the West Bank about 2.5 million people or more, effectively would be caged in the West Bank. They wouldn't be allowed to leave. They wouldn't be allowed to, if they happened to be stuck outside when this all happened, they wouldn't necessarily be allowed to return to their homes, to their families. It could, in effect, be a step towards turning the West Bank into what Gaza looked like before 2023, where the Israeli government imposed a closure on the entire territory, in essence treating it like an open-air prison.
Israel's statement announcing the closure today says it is happening, quote, at the direction of the political leadership, unquote. It was initially closed after a Jordanian truck driver crossing into the occupied territories killed two Israeli soldiers in a shooting and knife attack. It was reopened, closed again on Monday. Some in the occupied West Bank see this closure as retaliation for recognition, broader recognition of Palestinian statehood at the UN General Assembly. One Palestinian journalist, Tharwat Shakra, told CNN, quote, "It's revenge against the people," unquote. What, in your view, is the reason this is happening now?
Look, I mean, it's difficult to see it as not punishment against Palestinians for the recognition of statehood of Palestine by a number of states. However, the freedom of movement for Palestinians has been restricted further and further over the last 2 years since the October 7th attacks. You've seen more checkpoints throughout the West Bank. You've seen entire villages and other communities that have been, in essence, encircled. There's also been an unprecedented uptick in the number of Palestinians that have been killed by Israeli forces, a rise in settler violence, an increase in the detention without trial and charge of thousands of Palestinians. And I think this crossing is an escalation further, but it's in many ways a continuation of these sorts of restrictions that have been taking place now for months. And of course, they come against the backdrop of Israeli government's grave and systematic repression of Palestinians, which is part of its crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution, which Human Rights Watch and numerous other human rights groups, UN Commission of Inquiry and others have found.
So what is your sense of whether this closure will be permanent or temporary?
I think it's difficult to predict that. I mean, my instinct would normally be that it's impossible to imagine this being permanent because, again, it would condemn 2.5 million people to being having no access to the outside world, in effect. At the same time, we've seen red lines that, you know, that for a long time would have not been conceivable take place. So I have a difficult time saying it's inconceivable. You know, you have to treat this as what it is, which is that very much possible.
The Palestinian Foreign Ministry is calling for international pressure to be put on Israel to reopen this crossing, given that Canada and a number of other countries have now decided to recognize Palestine as a state. Do you think that there is an increased likelihood of meaningful international pressure on this specific move?
There should be. Recognition risks being an empty gesture without concrete action to actually, make that a reality. I mean, what's the point of recognizing a state if you're failing to lift a finger when the people of that state are being exterminated and when its land is being taken and when it's being blocked from its people entering or exiting? So I do think it's incumbent upon states to take concrete action, things like, imposing targeted sanctions, suspending preferential trade agreements. It includes support for the International Criminal Court, which has issued arrest warrants for Prime Minister Netanyahu. So concrete action is necessary in order for this sort of declaration to be to have any meaning beyond the words or the paper that it's spoken or written on.
I appreciate this, Omar. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Omar Shaker is the Israel and Palestine Director for Human Rights Watch. We reached him today in Palo Alto, California. In 1996, three Minnesota brothers were already such dominant duck painters that they were name-checked in the movie Fargo.
What do we got here? Arby's?
Uh-huh.
How's the painting going?
Pretty good. Found out the Hauptmans are entering a painting this year.
Aw, hon, you're better than them.
They're real good.
They're good, Norm, but you're better than them.
You think so?
The painters giving Norm a run for his money were Joe, Jim, and Bob Hodman, and they've only become more prolific in the years since that film was released. Now, this week, James Hodman won the prestigious federal duck stamp art contest for the seventh time. Between them, The brothers have racked up a total of 16 wins now. It's an impressive dynasty, but some people are grumbling that maybe it's time for the brothers to give some other duck painters a chance. And there are even conspiracy theories floating around that the contest has been rigged in the brothers' favor. Kira Sabin is a 26-year-old duck painter who entered this year's contest. We reached them in Inver Grove Heights, Minnesota.
Kira, be honest, when you heard the winner, you know, when the winner was announced, was there any part of you that just thought, not another Houtman, not again?
No, I wasn't sad that they won again. I was just surprised that it was that particular painting. It's not what I pegged as the winner from the start.
What about the painting, Three Buffalo Heads in Flight, made you think this isn't the one?
I thought there would surely be some judges that thought it was too busy or that the buffalo heads would look too small when it's reduced to stamp size.
Fair.
But they must have really liked it.
I'm looking at the picture right now, the painting. It's lovely. But for our listeners, describe a little bit more about what a buffalo head looks like.
Yeah, a buffalo head, they're cute little ducks. They have kind of an iridescent rainbow head in the sun. And this stamp features two drakes, two males, and then a hen flying.
So you're surprised, but not, you know, not upset that the Houtman name is on this prize one more time. But there are others, as you well know, some people might be surprised to hear that there are have long been conspiracy theories swirling around this competition and these brothers. You're trying to debunk them. But what are people putting out there? What exactly do they think is happening?
Yeah. To a general audience, I definitely get what it looks like. People have accused them of paying off judges, of painting each other's paintings, mm-hmm. since there's three brothers and they're all insanely talented. They've thought the whole competition could be rigged in their favors just because he's won 7 times now and 16 as a total, all three brothers. Mm-hmm. But I would argue that it's definitely not rigged.
How are you trying to change their minds, the people who think that there is something going on?
Well, first of all, I say that the judges are new each year, mm-hmm. and they wouldn't necessarily be able to identify a Houtman painting because it is anonymous voting throughout the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But really, the truth of the matter is the brothers have been doing this for like near 40 years, and they've kind of pioneered the style of what this particular contest is specifically looking for. So perhaps there is bias toward their work, but it's all in them just being amazing artists and winning.
They are beautiful paintings, but you are a painter as well, and you put forward a submission that you painted.
I did.
So how would you describe your offering and how your style is different?
It's funny because the overarching style is realism, but there are many different types of like personal styles when you approach realism. I think I paint with much more contrast than they do. They mm-hmm. are phenomenal at lighting a scene naturally. And I think I do a bit too much contrast, a bit too much detail, and they kind of know when to let it go.
What was your painting called?
I did a ruddy duck, one of the 5 eligible species. Mm-hmm. His name was Brimstone. That's what we named him. And it probably took me like 100 hours to paint him. But yeah, he's just a sweet little duck.
And how did you go about capturing that and spending all that time?
I documented the whole process. I was lucky enough to get some photo references of my own when me and my wife drove 19 hours to Connecticut to look at some ducks, and they had some ruddy ducks there. Mm-hmm. So I used my own photo references and then made a painting based off of that.
There are painters, as you know, who have said maybe the Houtmans should recuse themselves for a while. They've clearly shown their greatness, but they could make room for new emerging painters such as yourself.
They could do that. I know that me and most people who enter in the competition would like to win against the best of the best. Yeah. And they do have to sit out for 3 years after a win. So they really don't get as many opportunities to win right. as a general audience might think. But I don't want them to retire until they would want to.
You've met a couple of the Houtman brothers. What was that like?
I was starstruck. I'm not sure how many people would have been, but they were like crazy to be standing in front of me. I met Joe and Bob. They were so generous and so sweet. Bob, he came around the corner and he said, "Oh, I know who you are," because he had seen a video of me talking about them before.
Yeah.
And they were like, they would offer their process. They would talk about anything that you wanted to.
And what did they tell you about how they do it, how they capture the level of detail and have been, you know, as you said, pioneering painters in this space?
Yeah, I think they just spend a lot of time out in the wetlands observing. And then I know that they do like multiple paintings in a year and end up picking whichever one that they think has the best chance of winning, and they go with it. And I'm sure they show each other, get a little bit of critique here and there maybe, but they're just really good.
Yeah. A pleasure speaking with you, Kira. Thank you.
Yeah, it was great.
We reached Kira Sabin in Inver Grove Heights, Minnesota. Recently, I found a recording of one of my first music teachers, and I thought maybe you'd like to hear it. Excuse the sound quality, though. We were in the hills at the time.
Let's start at the very beginning. A very good place to start. When you read, you begin with
A, B, C.
When you sing, you begin with Do, Re, Mi.
Her name was Maria. She made our clothes out of curtains. And she wasn't my only great music teacher. I also have to salute Mr. Finn. He was unorthodox, but he really brought our class together to perform at the Battle of the Bands.
Just give this a try on my count, all right? 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah. Yes. Come on, come on, come on, come on. Now touch me, babe. Fada, fada, can't you see?
He's a great guy. And, you know, before I leave the subject, I just want to thank good old Mr. Fletcher. He was grumpy, but he sure did teach me how to play the drums.
Why do you suppose I just hurled a chair at your head, Neiman?
I don't know.
Sure you do.
The tempo?
Were you rushing or were you dragging?
And then he slapped me a bunch of times. But it really helped me to understand... Pardon me? Oh, I'm sorry. My director, Devin, is telling me those weren't music teachers from my life. They were music teachers from movies? Huh. He's also telling me about a new study by Australian researchers called Cinematic Portrayals of Music Teachers 1940 to 2025. Okay, they apparently looked at 50 teachers from movies and found that they were problematic. For one thing, teachers were often depicted as failed musicians, like Dewey Finn from School of Rock, or as paying too much attention, sometimes very negative attention, to a single student, like in Whiplash. Also, co-author Hugh Gundlach told ABC Radio, quote, "We see another trope where a tiny little innovation or change over a short period of time yields a massive result and a change in the students," unquote. See Maria in The Sound of Music, I guess. The problem is that all these portrayals might warp people's expectation of the job when most of the time it's not dramatic, it's just fine. You just teach students about music and no one throws a tempo tantrum.
Still sitting in
Joel Plaskett with Come On, Teacher.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, a friend remembers harm reduction advocate Louise Vincent, who challenged prevailing notions about addiction by going public about her own.
And a mother of two children with autism tells us that along with misinformation, the U.S. administration is also promoting hurtful ideas about what it means to be on the spectrum. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Thanks for listening to As It Happens here on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. And 10 o'clock, more great music continues on Headwaters with Malachi Coons. Support for KAXE comes from the Grand Rapids Players presenting the Great Gatsby September 26th to the 28th and October 3rd through 5th at the Rife in Grand Rapids. Celebrating the 100th anniversary since its original publishing, Friday and Saturday shows at 7, Sundays at 2. Tickets available at grplayers.com. We also receive support from the McKnight Foundation. Mostly clear tonight, lows near 55, and tomorrow sunny, highs in the mid to upper 70s. Our lows tomorrow night in the upper 40s, and Friday sunny, highs 70 to 75. You can answer our question of the week, where are your favorite places to go to look at fall colors? Text us 218-326-1234.
Since Monday, when U.S. President Donald Trump warned pregnant women against using acetaminophen, the backlash has been swift and widespread. Yesterday, Health Canada pushed back against Mr. Trump's claims that the use of medications like Tylenol during pregnancy is linked to autism. The World Health Organization has also rejected those claims. But the conversation began long before this week's announcement. Back in April, U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. pledged to find a cause for autism by September, and he made these remarks about the condition.
Autism destroys families. More importantly, it destroys our greatest resource, which are our children. These are children who should not be suffering like this. And we have to recognize we are doing this to our children, and we need to put an end to it.
That approach and what has followed has not been sitting well with Catherine Letang. Ms. Letang has autism and is the mother of two autistic children. We reached her in Maple Bay, BC.
Catherine, what have the past few days, what have they been like for you?
It's been a bit of a roller coaster, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously, when the news conference came out, and I think a lot of us had kind of, there had been snippets of what was going to be shared about Tylenol and cures and all of that. So I think a lot of us were kind of bracing ourselves. But honestly, like watching the news conference, it was way more infuriating. The language was far worse than I honestly could have ever expected. And yeah, at first I feel like there was a lot of anger in the community, and then it kind of shifted maybe towards just complete sadness of like, how are we here? Like, we fought so much for inclusion and acceptance, and we are back facing this awful rhetoric.
Our listeners just heard some past remarks from RFK Jr., that phrase that autism, quote, destroys families, in his view. He said it. He said it publicly. That phrase in particular, I know, really strikes a chord with you. Tell our listeners why.
Yeah, so for me, I'm a late diagnosed autistic woman. I've always been autistic, as my children have been. However, I only found out that I was autistic when I was 31 years old. For me, finding out that I was autistic was one of the best things that could have ever happened to me, because no matter whether it has a diagnosis or not, you always feel different. And for me, I never knew why. So it answered absolutely everything. And I've been able to raise my children with knowing that they're autistic since they were 2 years old. So we've been able to provide them with the support and accommodations and acceptance that I really would have benefited from too. And my children have very different support needs to me, but still being able to raise them with acceptance of who they are and provide them with adequate support has given them so many opportunities. So for us, autism is absolutely not a tragedy. It's who we are.
The U.S. president's comments in particular, what kind of message do you think all of that sends to mothers?
Yeah, Exactly. So, I mean, back in the 60s, the dominant theory was that autism was caused by refrigerator mothers. They were called refrigerator mothers because they were cold or didn't have a bond with their infant, and that is the reason that their child was autistic. So mothers were blamed for autism then. Now here we go again in today's society. We are now blaming mothers for taking Tylenol as the cause of their child's autism. It's really just the same story, but a different spin.
These comments are obviously by U.S. officials. They are broadcast widely, you know, and we're speaking about it on our program. But as our listeners also heard in the introduction, Canadian health officials, Health Canada, is pushing back against these claims about Tylenol and autism. Does that messaging in response from Canadian officials give you any modicum of relief?
A little bit. And I do think that this is what's important. I think everyone that has the credentials, the scientific background, governments need to come out united, rally around the autism community, but also around medicine. Like, this is bizarre. We absolutely cannot be doing this. Fueling skepticism around medicine is just so incredibly harmful. And I'm getting messages from parents constantly asking so many different questions. And even I got a message this morning from a friend of mine who was just like, okay, but there is this study. So then that is correct, right? Because there is a study linking it. I'm like, no, it's showing a correlation. A correlation is not the same as causation. And when you are just throwing this out into the general public, you are just creating fear, and it is incredibly irresponsible.
I spoke yesterday with Christopher Smith, who's a psychologist specializing in the diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. He heads up a research center in the United States. Here's a bit of what he told us.
The autism community can be divided on many fronts, and there are people that are, you know, looking very hard for environmental triggers. So I have to think that a finding like this a report like this, mm-hmm. I should say, not even a finding, yeah. A report like this will speak to that part of the population that is looking for an environmental cause.
What would you say, Catherine, to parents in your situation who do see things differently? And even if they're not looking to identify environmental factors, that they want to learn more. They want to know about potential causes and solutions as well. What would you say to them?
Yeah, 100%. There's a massive rift in the autism community. I hear it all the time, like, you know, that how dare I speak when I don't have the same struggles. However, I can tell you that your autistic child is worthy of a fulfilled life regardless of their support needs and acceptance. I don't hear much about support coming from the U.S. government.
Christopher Smith also said in that conversation yesterday, Catherine, that he used the word excited in terms of potential possibilities about further funding for research in this area. Is there any part of you that heard anything in there that thinks that this could lead to better focus, discussion, funding, research, and maybe supports?
I mean, it's maybe going to lead to, I mean, I don't know. It kind of seems like people think that there aren't scientists that have been researching autism for decades. Like, there are scientists who dedicate their lives to studying autism. But if we have people with a bias in control, like RFK Jr., who's promising research answers in 6 months, I mean, how sound is that research? We have been looking into autism for decades, and we still don't know. But RFK and Trump know within 6 months. That is just absolute nonsense.
Catherine, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Of course, you are more than welcome.
Catherine Letang has autism and is the mother of two autistic children. We reached her in Maple Bay, BC. Now a quick update on a story from yesterday's program. We spoke to Miami Herald journalist Jacqueline Charles about a police drone attack in Haiti that went badly wrong. It was meant to target a gang leader. Instead, it killed 8 children. As we mentioned in that interview, there was some concern that the drones used in that attack may have been provided by Canada. Today, the RCMP told us categorically that they were not. In a statement, the RCMP said, quote, "All drones donated by Canada have been accounted for, meaning they were not used in the attack. None of the drone models that have been provided by Canada were designed or intended for lethal use or load transport," unquote. We'll continue to follow the story. Louise Vincent didn't just use drugs. She was public and apologetic about using drugs because she wanted to improve the lives of her fellow drug users around the world. Ms. Vincent died last month at home in Greensboro, North Carolina. She was 49 years old. As a harm reduction advocate and the co-author of multiple academic papers on drug use and user safety, she was on the front lines of that work, meeting with users to provide syringes, naloxone kits, and occasionally life-saving intervention. In 2019, she delivered a keynote speech in Porto at the closing ceremonies of the International Harm Reduction Conference there.
I am a woman who uses drugs. I'm a woman who injects drugs. This is not something I've been able to say in a space and say and feel any kind of love. This is the space that I can say that. I'm from North Carolina. This is in the U.S., very conservative. We're in the middle of passing drug-induced homicide laws right now, which means that you're using with someone and they die of an overdose and you go to jail for murder. This is undermining our Good Samaritan laws. And most importantly, this is undermining every single thing we tell people who use drugs to do with people so that we can stay safe. Use with people, be with people, know the people you're buying from. These are the things that keep us alive, and we steady criminalize these actions. User-led services are the heart of harm reduction.
The late Louise Vincent speaking at the International Harm Reduction Conference in 2019. Maya Solovitz was one of Ms. Vincent's many friends. She's a recovered drug addict herself and the author of Undoing Drugs. She's written a lot about Louise Vincent. We reached her in Manhattan.
Maya, does that sound like the friend you knew?
Absolutely, yeah. It's just like I'm starting to cry here because, you know, just hearing her voice.
There is ferocity there and conviction, certainly, and many people working in harm reduction who are high profile describe themselves, as you know, as being in recovery. You're open about your past drug use, but she did not talk about herself as a former drug user, as we heard. She's adamant that the principles of harm reduction need to extend to people with no intention of stopping their drug use. That will be hard for many listeners to understand, but why was that so important to Louise Vincent?
Because people are human and we should value life. And when you are using drugs, well, almost every human being uses drugs. When you are using certain stigmatized drugs mm-hmm. that we make illegal, they try to take your humanity away. The idea is if we are just cruel enough to people who use drugs, they will quit and become, you know, sober model citizens, or at least we won't have to see them. And in reality, addiction is defined as compulsive drug use despite negative consequences. In other words, by definition, punishment is not a thing that would work, because if it did, you wouldn't be persisting despite negative consequences. So what harm reduction says is that we love you now. We see you as a human being now. For people who are Christian, you know, that is what Jesus was about. And most great religious figures, we're going to care about the people that society expels. And we're going to recognize that there is beauty and importance in every human life.
In 2016, Louise lost her right leg to a blood infection after a car accident. Then her teenage daughter, Selena, died. You know, she was dealing with addiction as well. What do you know about how the difficulties, those unimaginable realities for most of us, influenced her work?
I mean, her work kept her alive after that. And I was always so in awe of her to be able to just keep going. I mean, because basically the drug war killed her daughter and took away her leg. She was a person in traditional abstinence recovery when she got hit by a car. And she then could not get any pain relief because, of course, she's a scummy addict who doesn't deserve any pain relief. And, you know, simply touching an opioid is going to turn her back into a zombie, even though we know that that's not true. So she just avoided the medical system for so long that the leg needed to be amputated. And she wanted the best for her daughter. And she wanted to save her. And she thought that, you know, at the moment that she got her to go into rehab, you know, she was kind of running wild on the streets. She also, both of them had bipolar, and that is a very difficult condition to deal with because sometimes, you know, you're not so in control of yourself. So she thought, okay, she'll be in a rehab. At least I'll know she's safe, you know, like so many moms. And, you know, Louise had trained Selena to administer naloxone if somebody overdoses. It's an antidote to opioids, and it almost immediately revives people. And yet, in the rehab, they did not stock naloxone because they were afraid that it would encourage people to relapse. Mind you, you have people coming to a rehab because they are having difficulty controlling their drug use. And now you're going to penalize them for a symptom?
How did Louise deal with that reality, not just the loss of Selena, her daughter, but that there wasn't an overdose reversal protocol or antidote on hand at that facility?
I mean, as one does if one is actively using drugs, she called her drug dealer and was like, help. And the drug dealer was like, nope, not going to sell to you now because I don't think you're going to make it. And I want you to make it. And so with the support of her friends and because she felt like the work she was doing was necessary and that she was saving other people, she just kept going. And, you know, unfortunately, like in the last year or so, she had infections and she was just getting frighteningly thin. And, you know, eventually it took her life.
In that clip we listened to at the outset of our conversation that our listeners heard as well, you get a really good sense of the kind of person she certainly was publicly and perhaps privately as well. But as a friend, you know, away from her advocacy work, what was she like?
Funny, just funny and smart. We just had a real affinity because we both had dealt with addiction and mental health issues and both were sort of overthinking and like interested in science and philosophy and intellectual pursuits. So she, you know, she was just like super smart. And it was just like, I mean, I don't know, I was just kind of in awe of the way she was able to manage tragedies that each of them on their own, most people couldn't handle. People see people who use drugs and people with addictions as weak or lazy or whatever. Oh my God, was she not that?
Maya, I'm sorry for your loss. I do appreciate you taking the time to speak with me, though. Thank you for this.
Thank you so much.
Maya Solovitz is an author, a recovered addict, and a friend of the late Louise Vincent. We reached her in Manhattan. When you see it, you'll notice that it's black, white, and a little bit orange. And if you see it and you're in Ontario, tell someone, because it's not really supposed to be here. That's why bird watchers in Folliot, Ontario, were so thrilled this week. A crested caracara appeared in the small town. The bird of prey is usually not found north of the southern U.S. Chris Blom is one of those lucky birders, and his theory is that a hurricane or another kind of storm pushed it off course.
Well, we thought very exciting because that's quite far up north. It's totally out of its range. They're normally found in southern U.S., Mexico, West Indies, Central America, and all the way down South America. But up in Ontario, they're quite scarce indeed. And I think there's maybe just a handful of records of those birds showing up. It's a very rare bird. Some people will do life lists, so that's the number of birds that you see first time during the course of your life. Or there are people that are just generally interested in looking at unusual rare birds. The crested caracara is, like I said, a very southern U.S. South American species, so you would have to go for a fairly expensive vacation down there if you want to actually see this bird. So having a chance to see it up north is great. A good opportunity to see it. However, the bird didn't show itself until the very last minute.
Well, tell me about that moment. Where were you and what happened?
Well, it's interesting. So we're exploring the community of Folliette. We've had a lunch at the local restaurant there. We went to the local dump because the crested caracara is known to be a carrion eater. And we were not very successful. We spent a good 8 hours looking. We did find some dead beavers, and we saw bald eagles and turkey vultures eating on the carcasses, but no caracara. And so we were about ready to leave because we did not want to drive into the dark on Highway 144. So it was down to about 5:15. We're almost ready to leave. And all of a sudden, we hear these crows cawing, 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 and we know something's up. And all of a sudden, this caracara comes flying in over the lawn and lands up on top of the conifer right basically in front of us.
Chris Blom speaking with Marcus Schwabe, host of Morning North today. One of those handful of sightings happened in 1994. And of course, at the time, as it happens, called up a birder. From our archives, here's Tom Hintz speaking with guest host Joey Slinger in 1994.
One of the parties noted a very particular behavior of caracaras, which is that when they fly in search of food, and they have a very varied diet, so they can go after almost anything, they tend to sort of angle in. They'll sort of arc one wing up and sort of just drop right down like that onto the ground, plop, and then they'll run around on the ground. They're very long-legged, and they actually have flat toenails, and that allows them to run on the ground, and they observed that behavior. So they have several...
Flat toenails?
Yes. Birds of prey have some interesting adaptations.
So like if you see a caracara, you're not going to think you've seen a pigeon or a chachalaca or something like that.
No. But don't look for the flat toenails. Look for the plumage.
There are birds that don't belong up here that show up every now and then. I gather that's not the case here. If you're a bird watcher and you see the caracara, even on far-off Pelee Island, what's that... Is that sort of like hitting a Grand Slam home run in the bottom of... Is that like Joe Carter's home run at the end of the World Series there?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah?
For a bird watcher, that's definitely just like standing up at the plate in the World Series and hitting the big one. The only problem is then you've got to convince all your peers that you actually did do it because it's not on video. And in case you're... Well, you may be lucky and happen to have a camera to document it. But in the case of this bird... It's not only just the case of documenting the identification, but also whether it's actually what we call a natural vagrant, a bird that naturally came to come to this place, versus, say, for instance, a caracara that might have been in the possession of a falconer living in the Midwest and the bird escaped. That would be considered an unnatural occurrence.
Mr. Hintz, tell me, have you seen this? Is there a tick on your Ontario list?
Well, this one really hurts because I was on Pelee Island. It was one of the few times I've been to Pelee Island this year. I was on Pelee Island when the bird was there.
Yeah.
I was there when the bird was there.
Yeah.
And actually saw a bird of prey flying along the shoreline right where it was seen, when it was seen.
Yeah.
And went to reach my binoculars. They were already in the pack. By the time I struggled and got them out, it was gone.
Mr.
And I didn't know anything about it till the next day, but it hurt really badly then.
our little feathered hearts go out to you. Thank you for telling us about this.
Thank you.
From our archives, that was birder Tom Hintz speaking with As It Happens guest host Joey Slinger in 1994.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
And you are listening to 91.7 KAXE in Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE, Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can also join us at KAXE.org. This evening, it looks as though it's going to be mostly clear, lows near 55, sunny. Tomorrow on Thursday, highs in the mid to upper 70s, overnight lows in the upper 40s. Friday, sunny with highs 70 to 75, a southwest wind 5.